Hey everyone, it's Michelle.
And Brayden.
And this is Spooky Shit. This week we are going to be sharing some creepypasta with you all.
Hell yeah, some horror noodles.
And per usual, we're just going to be going back and forth.
Yeah, and Michelle's making me start this week.
Duh, I start on True Crime Weeks, you start on Creepypasta Weeks.
Is this a trend now?
It's an accidental trend that now I've noticed, and whenever we get mixed up in our weeks and you have to start on true crime, it just feels wrong. I'm like, this is my week.
You're right.
What the heck?
You're right.
Warning. This episode may contain graphic details. Listener discretion is advised.
All right, but before we start, what have you been up to?
Not much. Just work and school.
Fun.
I think it was on Monday, a little kid came in and I cut his hair.
Cute.
And yeah, it was my first kid, or I mean, like.
Your first child haircut?
Yes, that's what I was trying to say.
It seems like it'd be worse, like they'd be moving and shit.
Oh yeah, he did move a lot, but honestly, I feel like he was golden for my first, like, kid client.
Oh, good.
He did, like, kind of move his head a lot, and he was, like, mumbling. He was a little second kid.
Oh.
But, for the most part, like, he didn't cry or nothing. And
that's good.
Like, when I would tell him, like, oh, move your head this way, like, he was very chill. And,
yeah.
It was funny, because the first half of, the haircut, yeah, we were both, like, he was just on his phone, like, playing games. And I was just, like, really into his hair. Because also, he's my first, like, very, like, Afro-curly-haired client I've ever had.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just, like, making sure, like, to be focused. And just because with really, like, tight curls, you have to make sure to brush every time you, like, go up with the clippers. Basically, if you go up with the clippers and you don't brush it back down, you're basically not cutting anything and just pushing the hair up.
Oh, my gosh. I didn't know that.
Like, yeah, so, like, if they, like, shower and then their hair, like, you know, goes through a natural, like, state, you could, like, see it all, like, not blended.
They go home. You actually hadn't cut their hair at all.
Yeah. So, yeah, for the first half, I was just very focused. And then one of my educators came up to him and was just asking him questions about the game. And then I was like,
nice.
Oh, you know, maybe I should try to talk to him a little bit. And then, yeah.
You're just focused.
Yeah, I was just focused. And then I started asking him questions, and he was so talkative. Like, we were talking about everything. He was a cute little kid.
That's cute.
But yeah, we were, like, talking about, like, dinosaurs and sharks and, like, I don't even
I'm like, what are we talking about this child? That's pretty accurate.
I was like, he was really cute, though, and I was definitely entertained. And then he would get all shy because we would get really into a conversation. Mm-hmm. And then, like, classmates would just be, like, a bunch of girls would walk by and be like, oh, my God, he's so cute. And then he would get all shy. And he's I get so shy when people, like, say that I'm cute.
I mean, he is just sitting right there.
Yeah. But, yeah, he was very cute and tiny.
Oh, your first baby haircut.
Yeah, it was cool. I'm glad that I took it, because usually no one really has, like, set clients. It's just kind of like, oh, however many we have that day, they give them mm-hmm. out to, like, first, whoever shows up first, basically.
Yeah.
And I actually did not show up first that day, but none of the other seniors wanted to take it. And I'm very much so, like, whatever, you know, I'm going to take it. Like, it's more practice.
You've probably had a bad experience with kids before.
Well, you don't even know if it's a kid. We just see the name. Yeah.
Okay.
So we don't even know, like, what they're going to want. Nothing. It's just a name. But, yeah, most of the seniors are just kind of like, no, you take it type shit. And I'm like, damn, yeah, this is literally how it was in the daytime. Like, the seniors then would, like, pawn off their clients to me, too.
I was like, are they just, like, really picky and only will do, like, select people?
No, it's just kind of like, you know, if they don't want to, they won't.
Mm-hmm.
But
they'll
I'm like,
take a break.
Yeah, I guess. But I'm the opposite. I was like, I'd rather, like, practice on someone's head than, like, do procedures on my doll head.
Yeah, I mean, this is what you're trying to do. Whenever you're all done with school, you're going to have to take clients.
Yeah, that's exactly like, because I was actually talking to one of my educators about it, because he was like telling me how a lot of people would be complaining about how they'd be getting a lot of clients and like.
That's the goal.
Yeah, and how it's just because like there's this one girl who was complaining about how she gets like someone that wants highlights. And like balayages, like every day we take clients. So like she's been busy like all week, and that's basically all she does is highlights and balayages like every other day. And then I'm like, you do know you're at beauty school, right? You do know like this is your career choice. Like you're in a, that's basically your job.
There's probably a lot of people who did just because they're like, eh, that sounds easy and aren't interested in it and haven't really thought about the fact that you're going to have to do this every day now. Yeah.
I mean, I actually like it, and I, like, I'm, like, all for it, you know? Like, I'm not gonna, like, chicken out of an opportunity. I'm just like, you know, fuck it, I'll take it. No one else
live, is gonna laugh, take it. Learn.
But, yeah. Oh, let me tell you what happened to me yesterday.
Okay.
I actually showed up to work almost half an hour late.
Did you get in trouble?
Luckily, no.
Okay.
But I guess Wednesday night I had turned my ringer all the way down.
Oh no.
And, you know, put my alarm on and didn't check. And Thursday morning I actually like naturally woke up and it was like 4 something. And I have my alarm for 5 a.m. because I start work at 6.
Yeah.
But yeah, I woke up at like 4 something and I was like, oh, hell yeah, like I still have time. And so, you know, I closed my eyes and I woke up again and it was like 5:50. I was like, fuck.
It's like your subconscious was giving you a chance, like, no, you need to get up now. And you're like, no, it's okay, it's okay.
Yeah.
And that I checked, sucks. That sucks so bad.
I like checked my phone and it was 5:50 and the alarm was like had been going off. But since just the
quietly
ringer, yeah, it was like quietly, like it was not one peep.
That's fucking so happened like, to me too before.
Oh my god, I was like so I have never gotten up so quick. I literally like ran to the restroom, got dressed real quick, and then it was funny
because
Alaris actually wakes up at 6 a.m. and so her alarm went off as I was like going back to the room to like get my like phone and keys and all that. And she was all confused, and she was like, are you late? Or, like, am I tripping? I was like, yeah, I'm late. I gotta go, bye.
Oh.
She's like, she was just confused, because usually I'm long gone by the time she wakes up.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I, like, hauled ass to work, and literally, like, no one noticed.
Oh.
I was like,
all that stress for nothing.
Right? I mean, obviously, the only person that I noticed was my trainer, because, like, he... Every morning, like, he waits for me and just kind of walks me through, like, what to do each day. And obviously, he noticed.
He was understanding, though.
Yeah, he was like, oh, yeah, that's happened to me. And just kind of told me, like, for the future, like, you know, definitely change it in your settings and just be careful, you know, like, just because he really likes me.
Doesn't already want you to get fired?
Yeah.
Yeah, I had to change my settings because that same thing happened. We were supposed to have someone come fix a leak in our bathroom, and my alarm didn't go off. Or it went off, but quietly. Mm-hmm. And Robert had to come home from the laundromat to let somebody in. I didn't hear the doorbell. I didn't hear my alarm. I didn't hear anything.
Damn.
Whoops. Not as bad as being late to work, at least, but still stressful as shit whenever you wake up and realize what's happening.
Oh yeah, it like woke me the fuck up real quick. I was like, whoop, I'm awake, let's go.
Nothing wakes you up more than realizing holy shit, I'm late.
No, like dead ass.
Oh, that sucks. I'm glad that you didn't get in trouble.
Me too. I mean, like, I'm sure it'll come up like on my 30-day review.
Yeah, shit happens.
Yeah, I'm gonna be like, I swear that's a rare occurrence for me. Like, I'm usually a pretty punctual person. And I mean, I'm sure it's going to show, like, on the history. Like, I always clock in a few minutes early for that reason.
Yeah. And if they have an issue with it, then it's not something that you'd want to work where they make a big deal out of you being late one time.
Yeah. But yeah, other than that, it's been pretty uneventful. Just kind of stuck in a little routine of work and school.
Tiring.
Yeah, super tired. I was looking forward to this weekend, but I guess I'm going to have to wake up early tomorrow.
What do you have going on this weekend?
I guess we're taking Michelle to the airport.
Not me, Michelle.
Yeah, another Michelle. So I'm a little bummed about that. Because I'm like, fuck, dude, like, my only day of rest, and I'm going to have to wake up early and go.
Dude, that's like Robert. I feel so bad because he works nights. He basically only has Saturday off because Friday he's off at like 7 in the morning. So he was like talking to me about earlier today, and it's either he sleeps a couple hours and feels like weird and out of it all day, or he sleeps all day and he just wasted his day. And then he has Saturday off, and then Sunday he's spending his whole day waiting to go back to work at 10 p.m. And then I feel so bad because we have to go out to like a family dinner thing tonight because one of my sisters is moving. A different sister is moving and following the other one, actually. And I feel bad that I'm like, no, I think we have to go to it, unfortunately, because it's just he has such little time. And I'm like, let's go drive 30 miles each direction. Just go eat Brussels sprouts. They don't have the most vegan options there.
The Brussels sprouts are fire, though.
The Brussels sprouts at this place are actually really fucking good. Like, they do have a vegan burger, too. I mean, a burger that you can make vegan, but you pay the premium for, like, the non-vegan version. Sheesh. But the Brussels sprouts are better. Yeah, it's like a blue cheese something burger, and you pay the entire price for it, and then you get, like, half the shit taken off.
Don't you get the hookup there, though?
We do get a hookup. My sister Leah, that used to be on the podcast with us, works there, so it's, like, half off. But still, like... I don't want to pay any price on a... I mean, restaurant burgers are like $20.
True.
It's still $10.
Shout out to Leah. I appreciate it.
Shout out to Leah for this discount.
Yeah, I appreciate that one time. We like went all out and like she hooked it up and we were like,
wow. Oh yeah, it's where we do like all of our family shit now. It just sucks that it's so far from me.
Yeah,
but
true.
It is but cool getting half off. Yeah, it's in North County. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no. That's like Robert, though, feeling like, well, fuck, there goes this weekend. Mm-hmm.
I mean, luckily, I have Monday off, though, so.
Oh, that's good.
But yeah, I'm just kind of bummed. And I'm also dreading this weekend because it's supposed to be, like, 107.
The heat wave?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, I'm hot as shit right now. Cranky as fuck.
Yep. I'm also regretting some choices I've made to do this weekend because of the heat, but that's okay. I'm doing a subathon this weekend Sunday. Up to 24 hours. That's like only if I get like 250 subs, which I don't know about that. But I'm like, I'm not sure why I decided to do on a day that's going to be 93 degrees. And I'm finally going to be doing my cosplay. I'm going to do a cosplay as an old school RuneScape bot. So I have a bald cap, and I'm going to use eyeliner to give myself a fake goatee. And I'm like, do I want to do that when it's 90? Or I might wait till that night and be like, all right, I'm going to go take a break and put on makeup and, like, go put on the bald cap and stuff.
True.
I feel like shit's going to be melting on me when it's in the middle of the day. But, like, yeah, I could use the money. And also in September, they have, like, a... Subtimber thing on Twitch, so if you're gonna subscribe to people, it's like 20% off or something. So I'm like, eh, that's a good reason. And I found out I could stay up 24 hours last week, so that's why I capped it at 24 hours. It is possible. I told people for the longest time, no, I can't stay up 24 hours. Now it turns out I can. I'm a little scared about it. I don't think I will stay up 24. I'm sure I'll end before then, but still a little nervous. But I need the money, so I'll do it. And we have another sponsorship going again.
Another
this one. Time with HelloFresh.
Wait, again? Yeah.
Again, we had a HelloFresh one. I didn't realize it's been 6 months since we had that.
Damn, for reals?
Yeah, because I was looking and I was like, wow, it feels like they gave us another HelloFresh so soon. And I went and checked and it was back in February. And it's kind of unfortunate, though, because last time I got, like, everyone in my family to order. And now everyone in my family's already ordered, so they can't order again. And it's just me and my mom that have ordered. That's it so far. Might hit you up later. We'll see. But I'm not counting on making as much money from this one as I did last time. That's okay. It's still cool. I still have some dank foods on the way that I'm excited to make. I didn't get any of the... They have like one option every week that's actually vegan. I've been getting vegetarian stuff and I just replace the cheese with vegan cheese because they sound better to me. And I give the regular cheese to like Leah. I'm like, here's your little packet of mayonnaise and your weird two slices of cheese.
I'm dead. Just
as a treat.
Treat, treat.
Last time I had like a bunch of it because Robert and I both ordered meals and I had like so much cheese. It was like from like 8 different meals. And I think we went out to dinner because it was in February. It was probably for one of my sister's birthdays a few weeks after. And I just like gave a bags full of cheese to my oldest sister and was like, here you go. This is yours. Take this. Get rid of it. Eat it so it doesn't go to waste.
Yeah. It wouldn't go to waste in my house.
I know. Maybe I'll give it to you. You want some extra cheese?
I can't say no to cheese. We actually just got a big cheese wheel from Mexico.
Oh, really? I never had a cheese wheel before.
Oh my god, we fucking fucked that shit up.
Yeah?
Like with quesadillas, basically.
That sounds so good. I'm hungry.
I know, me too. I'm freaking starving. I had a cup of noodles for lunch, but it was at like 10, so...
That's 5 hours ago. Jesus Christ, you need to eat.
Oh my gosh.
Sorry to bum you out by doing that math, but you need to eat again.
How dare you. Now I'm depressed. No, I'm just kidding.
All I had was a single piece of bread, so I feel you.
Oh, shit.
I've only been awake for 2 hours, though.
Oh. I've been awake.
Yeah, remember, I go to sleep late.
Almost 12 hours.
Yes. Yeah. Dang, I go to sleep, like, after you wake up.
Yeah, I saw that you messaged me, and I had literally, like, woke up, like, 20 minutes later.
Really?
Yeah, I think you texted me at, like, 4:30 in the morning.
Oh, yeah, I didn't fall asleep till, like, 6.
And I literally, like, was getting up for work.
I started reading in bed, and I've been having a hard time falling asleep lately. Probably because I'm just, like, playing too much games and shit during the day. My mind's still going. Can't stop, won't stop. Ha ha ha. But yeah, that's I feel like those are the main things that have been going on. Yeah, I felt like I had a lot more to share, and then I realized that's because I had a lot to share on Boonbait because I had a lot of account progress in Old School RuneScape, but I don't think you guys want to hear about how I got my woodcutting level up.
That's funny.
So I guess that's actually it. Subathon and HelloFresh. If any of you guys want to come by the Subathon, once this episode comes out, I'll be live. Twitch.tv /Boonbape, BUNEBAPE. If you tell me you're from this podcast, that would be really cool. Because I'm scared no one's going to hang out with me.
That's what you said last time.
Yeah, but last time it was our 1 year affiliate. And this time it's like not for a reason, you know? And the other day, like, our stream's been doing, like, pretty well. Like, we have, like, 20-something people watching the stream most of the time. Sometimes more if we get rated by other people. And the other day, for an hour, I was at 3 viewers. And I was like, holy shit. It's scary. It's scary just being, like, all of a sudden, like, does everyone hate me?
No.
I know. It's, like, logically, I know they probably don't. But what if they do?
They don't.
Never know. Yeah. No, probably just people are busy. But anyway. That's all I got going on. If you would like to start your horror noodles.
All right. So we actually talked about this before.
Yes.
That Michelle actually had this on her list, but we don't think she ever actually read it out loud.
I had it
on
my list
guys.
Like in January, February, and March. I kept adding it to my list, and I don't think I ever got to it.
Yeah, I was like, because I don't remember ever like hearing this. I feel like
I don't even remember what the story's about. I just remember the name because it was so long ago.
You'll remember once I read it, I feel.
Yeah. I don't think we read it, but if it sounds familiar, whoops-a-daisy.
Yeah, sorry.
It's a really good one. It I remember is. Thinking it's really good.
Yeah, I think it's really good. All right. Yeah. Well, it is titled Those Deep Dark Wells by Michael Page. The terrible thing happened at night, as most terrible things do. While I clicked away at my home job as a transcriptionist, I'd often watch the boys playing in the backyard. They'd be at it for hours, acting some scene with foam swords and plastic guns, only stopping when the sun left to rise elsewhere. Seeing Mason happy made me happy. He'd finally found a friend. His father left us when he was 6 months old, and more or less, he held no role in his life. Sure, there were the occasional visits every few years, but even those were short and rare. Not even so much as the annual birthday card. What a shitty dad. Anyways, sorry. Perhaps that was why Mason anchored himself such a secure distance from other kids. A point driven home by his fifth grade teacher and several others. Part of me didn't blame him. Kids in school, especially the ones I can recall, weren't the friendliest bunch. If you were lucky, you could pick out the sharks from the minnows and avoid them. But honestly, they all looked the same, twined together in the same concrete box. "Please give him a best friend," I'd whisper at my bedside every night, sending out the same message to God, or at least to something just as benevolent, to hear my prayer. Give my son his first best friend. Then one day, much to my wonderment, Mason brought Todd home for a playdate. He was a petite boy with mismatched clothes, unkempt hair, and the bluest eyes you've ever seen. I was ecstatic, relieved that my son had finally cracked open his shell and found a buddy. "I saw him at the park," Mason told me when I asked how they met. "He was sitting alone at the swings, like he was sad. When he saw me on my bike, he waved, and I waved back. Then we hung out, and he was really cool." As he shared this, I couldn't help but smile at his excitement, so much deserved by the loneliest boy in the world. That night, they had a sleepover and passed out in the living room. From my bedroom, I can hear the muffled speech of our television, which they had left on. Sighing, I untucked myself out of bed and walked sluggishly down the stairs to them. Light from the screen pulsed and stretched over the sleeping boys. Mason was swaddled in his blanket on the floor while Todd was curled up on the couch. I scanned for the remote, and after no luck, I moved to shut it off myself. Crink! A lone bag of chips crinkled under my foot. From the couch, Todd's shape twitched and then bolted upright. I meant to say sorry, but I was stopped short. When Todd jutted awake and opened his eyes, I couldn't see them. They hadn't rolled up in their sockets or slipped into their sides. They were simply gone. Two holes of singular darkness. Todd had blue eyes, vividly blue eyes. But at that instant, not even a glow of the television reflected off those dark membranes, black as Santa's coal. Then he blinked, and the eyes returned. Before I could say anything, his mouth stretched into a yawn, and his body slumped back into the cushions. I was stiff as a board, somewhat relieved I hadn't shrieked, and woke them both up. My thoughts told me it was a trick of the light, as did any speck of reason. Vision played games with you that way. I switched off the television and went back to bed. A few weeks later, on an especially windy evening, a knock came at the door. Todd was there as usual, seesawing on his soles patiently. "Hi there," I smiled. "Hi," he smiled, his thin neck cocked. "Can Mason come out to play?" Before I even had to answer, Mason already squeezed past me, still working on one of the arms through his jacket sleeve. "Bye, Mom." I watched as they disappeared down the street. The rule was to be back before dark, and to their credit, the boys always returned just as the sky started to dim. On that particular outing, they came home with some cool rocks they'd found and dirt-clotted sneakers. By the time Todd was ready to walk back home, it had fallen too dark for him to go alone. I gave him a ride with both boys in the back seat. It wasn't a far drive, as his house was only a few streets away. Every so often, my eyes would slip back to the rear view and see Todd watching the street, Mason dozing off next to him. As we passed beneath the street lamps, a bar of light would creep through the window, roll over his face, and vanish over his head. The car suddenly rocked as my wheels rolled too hastily over a speed hump. His gaze left the window and met mine, only this time, as the slanted light skimmed over his features, blue eyes did not look back at me. They were gone, blotted out by the same oily darkness. Silent, murky circles. Even his skin, in just that quick moment, looked different, like dry, mottled clay fit poorly over a skull, lips bloodlessly shriveled. I slammed on the brakes, jostling all of us with such a certain lurch. Mason gasped himself into a wide-eyed awareness. As fast as it had happened before, the straight-faced horror in my backseat returned to such a sweet young boy, shocked and surprised. "Sorry, I breathed. Sorry about that, guys. I thought I saw a cat in the road." We reached Todd's house, a white ranch style with a flowering dog tree in the front yard. As the boys said their goodbyes, I could only stare into the dashboard, my heart sending tremors down my arms. The world fell off its tilt, as if the lines separating actuality and nonsense were blurred. I was disoriented by how real it seemed, his eyes like deep, dark wells. His unhealthy skin stretched and pulled like a death mask. My thoughts clashed with the fold of my brain and formed logic, and eventually, logic won. It was all in my head, period. But despite how far-fetched it sounded, I actively avoided eye contact with Todd, not even giving a sliver of opportunity that oily pitch to return. If it even happened in passing glance or in a quick double take, I'd be circling the rim of a mental collapse. A week later, I went to pick up Mason from Todd's house. I'd pulled up along the curb, texted, "I'm here," and waited there for some time. There was no sign he'd read my message, nor did he answer any of my calls. When I got tired of waiting, I twisted the keys out of the ignition and made my way up the slim walkway. The house was missing a great deal of shingles, which scarred its roofline in dark patches. The rain gutters were clogged and stunk of decomposing leaves. I knocked briskly and waited. The door unlocked, held only partially open by a door chain. "Yes?" the face peeking out asked. His voice was nasally, like it was lodged somewhere in his throat, right in the pit of it. "Hi, I'm Holly, Mason's mom, here to pick him up." The door closed, then opened fully as the chain slid out of its holder. The man on the other end was lanky, with onset baldness widening his forehead. His eyes tired and heavy. "Oh, sorry about that," he said, flashing a thin-lipped smile and offering a handshake. "David." "The boys are probably still on their way back, but they'll be here any minute now. You can come inside and wait if you like. I've got some tea ready to go." I took him up on the offer and followed him inside. At our immediate right was the living area, where a woman sat watching rom-com on the television. Paying no mind to the sound at the door, she kept her back to us. Beneath the show's timed laugh track, I could hear the sound of hard, labored breathing. Hanging over the side of the sofa drooped a thin skeletal wrist. On the wall, a gray Kit Kat clock shifted its eyes and wagged its tail. The kitchen was small, with a triangular arrangement of a sink, stove, and refrigerator. A small dance between the three. Flowery wallpaper looped around the room. A formica top table sat against the wall with minty green chairs. I took a seat in one as David retrieved some cups from the cabinet. The smell of light orchid drifted through the air. "Hope you like green tea," he said quietly as he filled the cups and brought them over. "Green is fine," I replied, taking the cup from him. "Thank you." He planted himself in the chair. "They're really fond of each other, aren't they? The boys, I mean." "I'd say so. You can hardly keep Mason away," I laughed. By this point, I had noticed the dark pouches beneath his eyes more clearly. In fact, his overall appearance seemed to hang in a mournful sag. Whatever supplement he needed, he was missing a lot of it. "So, how long have you been in the neighborhood?" I asked for the sake of conversation. "Oh, a good while now," he mused, rubbing a finger along his cup. "Really? I'm surprised Mason didn't meet Todd sooner. Our houses aren't too far from each other." "Todd?" he asked, as though needing a moment to remember his own son's name. "Oh, yes. That is pretty surprising. He, gets around." "Mason's never seen him at school. Does he go to a different district?" Lines ceased his mouth. "School? Well, we..." From the living room, a harsh, guttural coughing reached us. David's neck swiveled toward the sound. "Excuse me, my wife needs me." He left his chair and hastily went to her. Not too long after that, the front door opened as Todd and Mason arrived. As we said our goodbyes to David, his silent wife, he clasped my hand in a tight shake. "It was nice meeting you, Holly. Really, it was." When he released his grip, I realized something was left in my palm. When we were back in the car, I folded it open. "What's that, Mom?" Mason asked. "Nothing, sweetie." I smiled back at him, placing the crumpled note in my lap, a phone number, a time to call, and the word "help" scribbled into its loose leaf. It was nightfall when I unfurled and read it again. I was in the backyard, occupying a seat at our fire pit, my cell phone in one hand and a cigarette pinched in the other. The note said to call at 8, which was only 5 minutes away. As the time drew closer, my chest grew tighter with anxiousness. Moments ago, I'd snuck into my own room, pulled out the bottom shelf of my dresser, and unearthed the pack of Marlboros hidden there. 3 years I'd been without him, and 3 years I'd kept my promise to Mason to stop smelling like an ashtray. But tonight, shamefully, they were the only thing holding me together. When the clock on my phone pulsed 8, I took a long drag on the cigarette and dialed the number. The tone chirred in and out a few times and finally connected. "Hello?" David's voice chattered on the other end. "Who is this right now?" My heart rattled in my throat. "It's Holly, Mason's mom." The voice exhaled and then returned briskly. "I need you to listen to me, okay? Are you listening?" "Yes, I'm listening." "Keep it away from your boy." The fire pit popped and spat a few embers. "Keep what away? What are you talking about?" "Listen," he snapped, a manic weight to his words. "Don't let Mason come over here anymore. It isn't safe for him. Don't even let it go over there. You have to stop this now." I twisted my neck back towards the house and then leaned forward in my chair. "Are we talking about your son, right?" "Isn't my son," he scorned. "Not at all. Not in any way." "You need to calm down. If you need help, I can call the police." "No, no, no police," he screamed, his voice tight and stressed that it splintered on the other end. "It will take more from her if you do that. My wife, she can't handle much more. It's taking something from her, taking something from me. We can't get rid of it now. It's too late for us, but not for you. You can stop this." He started to weep and mutter to himself. "It came to our door to use the phone. Why did we let it in? Why did we let it use the fucking phone?" Something stirred in his background and he paused and then whispered, "Keep it away from him," and then hung up. I'm not sure how long I sat out there, but it was long enough for the flames to shrink into powdery mounds. When I entered the house again, Mason was on the couch with his tablet. "You smell weird," he said, taking note of me. "The fire pit," I lied. "My thoughts too heavy to muster it. Anything else?" He flashed a big smile and tactfully asked, "Can I have a sleepover at Todd's this weekend?" "No," I stiffly answered. "That isn't going to work." "Why not?" he persisted. "Todd always sleeps over here. Why can't we do his?" "Because, Mason," I said no. End of story. He shot an icy look of defiance at me. "Fine, then he'll sleep over here then." "No, he won't. We're going to take a break from Todd for a while." His jaw opened, flabbergasted. "You can't do that." "I just did," I said, perhaps a little too matter-of-factly. As I walked back up the stairs, I could feel the burn of his eyes watching me on every step. Both of our nights now ruined. David's deranged garbo on the phone sat with me for the rest of the night. I had no idea what to do, what to fix, what to think. Keep it away? It isn't safe for him? The message so vague, but also desperately clear. I had to keep Mason safe. That was all that mattered. The next day, after Mason was back from school, I sat him down on the couch. "I'm sorry for last night," I said. "I was very stressed, but that is not the way I want us to speak to each other again, okay?" His eyes naturally scanned the floor. "Okay. I love you, Mason, and no matter what, I want you to be safe. So there are a few things I need to know about Todd. Will you do that for me?" He nodded again, his sneakers softly kicking the backpack slumped on the carpet. "Did he ever act weird or strange to you?" He shook his head. "What about his parents? Did he act different around them at all?" Same answer. I wasn't sure how to word my next question, but I did my best anyway. "Did he ever do something with his eyes?" This time, Mason nodded. My heart squeezed itself smaller. I wanted so much to change the subject, to retreat to the kind cadence of sanity. But I had to know more. I had to protect my son. "What did he do with his eyes?" "A trick," Mason replied hesitantly. "Told me not to tell anyone, though. You have to tell me." His lips crinkled, trying to keep a secret zipped up. Then he finally spoke. "He can make him disappear." I felt drugged by his words, my head even feeling lighter, like all the logic in the world had just been raptured away. "You did see them," my thoughts repeated. "You did see the dark, deep dark wells." As quickly as all my self-doubt left, a scrim of dread filled my empty spaces. "Did it scare you?" I asked. "A little," Mason replied absently. "He said not to be, though, that he'd show me how to do it." I grabbed his shoulder, making him jump suddenly. "He didn't though, right? He didn't do anything to you?" He looked confused, like I was the one talking crazy now. "No. I know that he is your friend, Mason, but I need you to promise that you won't see him anymore." Mason's gaze flicked back to mine, his eyes wide with betrayal. "What?" The tears began to come down. "Promise me," I repeated, words like razors scraping down my tongue. "I don't want to, Mason." After much hesitation, he tearfully replied, "I promise." I hugged him, closed my eyes, and surrendered to the cruelty of it all. For the rest of that hellish week, I kept my ears tuned for the knock at the door. For whatever reason, Todd never used the doorbell. Inevitably, the knock came. Behind the frosted glass of our front door, I could see Todd's vague shape teetering on his soles. When the door opened, he smiled up at me. "Hi, can Mason come out to play?" "Sorry, dear," I smiled back. "Mason can't play today." The corner of his mouth lifted as his neck cocked to the side. "Can he later?" "No, I don't think so. Sorry." His nose wrinkled and the skin between his eyebrows creased. "Okay." I closed the door, watched him leave, and that was that. It might take a few times, but eventually the message would sink in, leave my son alone. I felt a sense of pride behind that, and what could possibly better protect a boy than his mother? But when I turned and saw Mason's cold eyes from the stairs, the pride all but evaporated. When Todd returned the next day, I gave him the same answer. Then the day after that, and the one after that. I couldn't even refuse to answer when he knocked. Otherwise, he'd just sit there and wait. Knock again, wait some more, knowing full well we were home. 4 straight evenings of it. And poor Mason, he had every right to despise me for this. No parent could want to wall themselves between their son and his best friend, his first friend. But what choice did I have? We were drifting apart, orbiting ever farther away from one another. He was my prisoner, and I was the judge sentencing him back to a lonely world. Surely he'd make new friends, right? The world was full of them, and if anything, this was proof that he could find them. That thought helped me cope, anyway. When the knock came for the 5th time in a row, my tolerance had run out. Todd wasn't catching on, and to make matters worse, more irritating, it was 8 or so at night this time. Part of me hoped it was someone else, maybe a neighbor bringing him a package by that was wrongfully left on their doorstep. But I knew better than that, and I was not allowing this to go any further. Mason was doing his homework at the kitchen table when I passed by him. No acknowledgement whatsoever. When I pulled the door open, Todd was standing beneath our porch light, both shoulders hunched over his ears as though expecting me to smack him. And perhaps verbally, that's what I did. "Go home," I said absurdly. "We're done. No more of this, all right?" "Can Mason come out to play?" he asked sorrowfully, as though it weren't after dark. "No, Todd, he can't. And he won't the next day or the next. Now go home and stay there." His small arm rubbed his sleeve nervously. "It's really dark. I don't want to walk home alone. Can I use your phone to call my parents?" I felt absolutely cruel, but I also knew the game he was trying to play. "You walked here on your own, you can walk back on your own." Then, as I moved to close the door and end the conversation, Todd made his eyes disappear. The darkness washed over them quickly and seemed actually to curdle in his sockets. A thickening, horrible texture. His face became milk wax, the sad child disappearing behind it. Beads of perhaps sweat dripped from his temples. One ran into his eye and vanished into the void. "I want to come inside," he spoke, the sorrowful note in his voice also gone. My heart stuck into a deep, slow throb. I felt the need to pinch my side, to tweak it hard enough to draw blood to wake from this moment. Between the dead, shriveled lips, I could see the decayed tips of black teeth. "Can I please come inside?" he asked. "No," I said semi-reactively. His black, craving eyes narrowed at me. For a moment, I actually thought they'd start to cry. But it was just the darkness dribbling down his cheeks, oozing like oil slicks. "I just want to play with Mason." The sound of it, the sound of that horrible face saying my son's name, snapped me out of shock. I slammed the door closed and quickly locked it. Mason stood stiffly in the kitchen. His expression was only a shimmer of consciousness, vacant as only a sleepwalker. "Mason, look at me, honey. It's all okay. Everything's going to be okay." But his unfocused eyes were not facing me. 3 firm knocks came from the door. When I turned to face it, a dark shape lingered behind the frosted glass. A tall figure, taller than any adult, was hunching to look inside. And from behind a single pane that separated us, its vague shape didn't move. From the other side, Todd's childish voice was still calling. "Can I please come inside? Don't you want to play, Mason? Don't you want to play?" I could feel it watching us, the static vibrating in the air. When I tried to move Mason, he refused to budge, staring emptily toward the evil thing behind the glass. Heavy as he was, I scooped him up in my arms and bolted for the stairs. "It won't break in," my thoughts uttered. "It isn't allowed to." That much I was sure of. If it wanted to get in, it would have by now. It needed to be invited. I shut both of us away in the bathroom upstairs, and when the sounds of the front door finally ceased, Mason snapped out of it. He was confused, like he just missed everything that transpired. I wasn't sure whether to consider that a blessing or not. Perhaps it was. And perhaps also, it was not God that answered my prayer. It was impossible to digest what happened that night. Sometimes I'd linger on the stairs right on the top step and watch the doorway, wondering if the glass would suddenly darken, if Todd's voice would slip through and ask to come inside. One night, David had left a voicemail on my phone. "She's gone," his voice whimpered. "It got what it wanted from her, drained her dry. Now my wife won't wake up, and it's left us. I don't know what it wants from your boy, but it wants something. No matter what, don't let it back inside." The message cut out after that, and he still won't answer my calls. Todd never did come back, and I wouldn't have it any other way. Strangely enough, the one least affected by all this was Mason. I was worried to see him fall back into that distant bubble, but that isn't what happened. He'd started to make friends with the other kids around the neighborhood. New friends. Normal friends. He'd become a real social butterfly, and despite my brain ripping itself apart to understand what I had seen, I at least had the comfort to cling to. Seeing Mason happy made me happy. Lately, though, I've been feeling strange. It's been harder to feel motivated about things, let alone get out of bed in the morning. Even my appetite has started to dwindle. Day by day, I've been growing increasingly sapped and lethargic. I don't know what's wrong, but it's getting worse. Mason's been helping me get around the house, even going out of his way to play chef and make me things to eat. He's a good boy, but sometimes, dear Lord, I catch something in his eyes. Something that shouldn't be there. But it's only the trick of the light. Please, God, let it only be a trick of the light.
I like that one a lot. Dun, dun, dun. Da, da, da. That's a good one.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
All right. So my first story is called The Transfiguration of Consumption. This is by Christine Blackwicks. When she first brought home the iron skillet, no one questioned her sudden culinary skills. Except for maybe her mother. Honestly, Katrina, I don't understand what's gotten into you. I've never seen you express one whit of interest in food. It was also her mother who commented on her weight. Honestly, Katrina, with these fancy meals you effortlessly whip up, I don't know how you stay so skinny. Do I need to worry about an eating disorder? She patted her stomach. I swear these extra 5 pounds are all on you. And her mother, who months later lamented, "Honestly, Katrina, you look downright skeletal. It's like your weight's sloughing off on me. Frankly," she paused, lowering her voice, "it's like you're plumping us up like chickens. Maybe consider lightening the feed." She winked. "In the meantime, be a dear and warm us up a little of the bourguignon from last night. There's a lot of fancy foods whose names I'm going to mispronounce. Just a heads up." Katrina stared down at the overly rogue cheeks, her mother too still to be sleeping. This coffin, the third she'd bowed over in as many months, her eyes too numb for tears, her heart too hollowed out for pain. The doors of the cathedral opened, liberating a breeze that whispered against her cheek. Her mother's voice caressed, "Honestly, Katrina, I think you fed me to death." 6 months earlier. When her grandmother died, it fell to Katrina to clean our house so it could be put up for sale. With her part-time job as a waitress and a full-time job as an aspiring illustrator, everyone in her family assumed she had the free time to make it happen. It was a rainy Tuesday afternoon, and the closets under the eaves smelled like cedar and wet leaves. Her back ached from ducking around tight spaces, and her nose ran from the dust and crumbling carcasses of insects. Rubbing her back, she scooted out of the closet and fell on the nearest twin bed. Kat cocked her head as she studied her progress. As sole worker in this establishment, she determined that anything deemed worthy of selling was her profit to keep. An assortment of personal items caught her fancy. Her favorite, a paperback book of photographs of women from the 60s fishing topless. A gag gift for her brother's stocking come Christmas. The sky deepened as she took load after load down the narrow staircase, frequently knocking her knuckles against the walls as she navigated the precarious incline. She forced herself to do one last sweep to make sure she hadn't missed anything. Flashlight in hand, she commenced an inspection of the upstairs attic room. The temperature had dropped and she shivered. Although she'd never admit to her siblings, Kat always felt a bit creeped out by the closets with their gaping orifices, open on either side of the twin beds. The two halves of a mouth about to close and swallow its inhabitants. Without her grandmother's presence, the house felt starved. With a sigh of determination, Kat entered the room, flipping a switch that didn't light. She stomped over to the first closet, shining her beam. Empty. Kat pushed the tapestry of the other closet aside, mind contemplating takeout options. When she swept the light across the dark recessed corner, a patch of shadow glimmered. Frowning, she scurried under the flap to take a closer look. She crouched down. The light stuttered off an object she'd missed. Positioning the flashlight to shine into the corner, she crawled to the spot. Reaching out, she touched cool metal. She wrapped her hands around the outstretched length and tugged. It clanged against the boards as it bounced over to her. The heft, too much for one arm, had her dragging it while she collected her flashlight and fell back onto the carpet of the room. She took a deep breath, studying the object on her lap. A cast iron skillet. Light from her torch absorbed into the flat black surface and reflected back a kaleidoscope of color. When she turned over the skillet, property of KOOC appeared stamped into the metal. An odd name, she looked forward to looking it up on the internet when she got home. Hunger gnawed. Could she cook tonight? Her mouth watered as her mind rifled through various concoctions. Then she laughed, remembering the failed romantic dinner she'd burned for her ex. She cradled the cold metal to her chest. An idea was forming around a simple grilled cheese. Her belly gurgled and she hauled her find down the stairs. She locked up the first she planned her list for the store. When she got home, she knocked on Barry's door. He lived a couple of units over. "Well, this is a surprise," he grinned. "I'm making dinner. Are you interested?" His smile deepened. "Kit Kat, I've never known you to cook. Is this a euphemism for something more nefarious?" Kat rolled her eyes. "Maybe if you're lucky. But I'm serious about the food. You in?" "How can I refuse?" He ran a hand down his thick braid. "What can I bring to drink?" At the deli, she'd picked up a loaf of uncut multigrain bread, blue cheese, smoked uncured bacon, beefsteak tomato, basil, and a sweet onion she planned on caramelizing in honey and butter. "You wouldn't mind a chance to have a pale ale or IPA, would you?" "You are full of surprises this evening. See what I can do and be right over." Kat became enchanted with the thrill of something new. Elements of spice, urban ingredients called to her, much like a mysterious aubergine door or a persimmon rose birthing a fairy princess. Refescent threads of saffron, pearlescent sheets of spring onion, or the transfiguration of gray meat to bronze perfection lured her like a sailor to the sea. She started with easy meals like exotic scrambles, but soon found herself crafting soups and complex sauces. With increasing frequency, her table was full of friends eager to share her creations. Barry was the first to offer up his belly as an official taste tester, but he certainly wasn't the only one. Her mind processed ingredients, diet preferences, and allergies with the efficiency of a calculator computing algebraic equations. She conspired with three different bakers, knew a local butcher by name, and became friends with the owners of her favorite farmers market stalls. All found their way to her table. Katrina worked in a frenzy, painting, cooking, and hosting, so much so that regardless of how decadent her meals, weight started to melt off her frame. She found herself digging through her closet for items that hadn't fit in years. One night, as Kat fell into her nest of a bed, in that delicious in-between place before falling asleep, she found herself concocting a muffin recipe. A couple of her coworkers from the restaurant had been over for a meal and bragged her cooking rival Damien's, the head chef at their 5-star establishment. Ever since he'd heard the rumors, he'd been harassing her to bring something in. The problem was her real inspiration revolved around things that could be cooked with a black pan. Yet, as she fell asleep, a breakfast muffin evoking the seasons percolated. Dissipating into an endless abyss of night, she floated in darkness without time until, sweat-bathed, she awoke. She stumbled in the kitchen to make coffee and discovered a strange item sitting on top of her stove. A muffin tin. The shade so dark it sucked the sunlight from the room. She ran her fingers around the smooth, opalescent surface. Lifting it took two hands, and on the bottom she read the same strange imprint. Property of KOOC. Upon bringing the frying pan home, she did a brief search on the computer but couldn't find any company information about the brand name. She'd lost interest. Now, though, somehow, she'd inherited a companion piece. Probably a gift from Barry. He had a key to her place and the wherewithal in both time and resources to find other pieces from the set. She grinned and threw on her coat and shoes, eager to rush out to the store. Her seasons of change muffin wouldn't make itself. When she'd mentioned to Jenna she was bringing a treat for Damien, she hadn't expected people who weren't on shift to show up. Topiary animals crawled up the walls, trailing tails of ivy. Branches intertwined overhead, concealing tiny spots illuminating each table, leaving the surrounding space in shadows. The decor was crafted to create the illusion of picnicking in a forest. The intimate space only had room for 30 guests, and it felt like she had an audience. "You all aren't here because of me, are you? I certainly didn't bring enough to feed the horde of you." Jenna stepped forward. "We can't wait to witness Damien's reaction. We're dying to see what you brought." Damien stood in the open doorway leading the kitchen, his pristine chef whites crisp and starched. "Am I smelling something for me?" he waved her forward. "I don't have all day." Kat sat her back down on a verdant velvet settee and carried her basket over to him. She peeled off the kitchen towel, revealing the still warm muffins. "Think it's best if you take a bite, incorporating the top of the muffin to the very bottom." The crown had a slight pink color, enhanced with a speckled blush glaze. The room fell silent as Damien picked one up, inhaling deeply. He opened his mouth wide and took a bite. His eyes closed. Kat laughed. "I know, right?" "What is this?" Damien asked after he swallowed. "An idea I had before I fell asleep last night. I wanted all four seasons in one solitary bite." "Starts with summer. A strawberry basil glaze?" he asked. "Yes, and I used almond flour and paste to make the first half of the base to illustrate nutty warmth of fall." "And," he continued for her, "the traditional bite of sour apple pieces rolled in cinnamon to represent winter in the center, followed by coconut flour infused with rhubarb to symbolize spring." He appraised her. "I have to have the recipe. Did you use a particular pan?" "You have no idea how particular," she thought as she remembered the mysterious delivery left on her counter. "I did." "Any chance I could borrow it for our Mother's Day brunch? This would be a highlight." Kat flushed with pleasure at the compliment. "Sure, but I want my name on the menu and a table for me and my mom." "Done." He moved to go, but turned back to gently pry the basket from her arm before making an escape back to his lair. They sat in a window seat framed in fresh flowers, her mother elegant in pearls in a cream sheath. Kat observed her closely as she bit into the muffin. For a brief moment, her mother's gold-flecked eyes widened. Kat couldn't wait any longer. "And?" "Magical." Her mother licked her lips, as if I've traveled the globe in one bite. "Damien's quite the catch. Have you considered dating him?" "Damien didn't come with a recipe. I did." Kat pointed at the menu. "Look, I even have a chef credit to approve it." She ground her teeth in an effort to keep a neutral expression on her face. "Honestly, Katrina, you're telling me you're a chef now? What happened to illustrating?" Her mom smiled as she said it, but there was an undercurrent of mirth below her words. Kat willed her eyes not to roll. "I'm still an artist, only my subject matter is metamorphosized." "Why am I not surprised?" Her mother kept picking at the pastry, tearing bits and eating them. "So what is it now?" "Portraits of food. You should come over and I'll show you." Kat wished her mother would join her for a meal and look at her work. Her mother gazed at her candidly. "Katrina, should I be concerned about your fixation on food when you look skinnier than I've seen you in quite some time? Are you eating?" "Obviously, Mom. I couldn't create recipes without tasting them. I think I finally found my passion." "I'm glad to hear that." She glanced down at her plate, the muffin gone. "Can't believe I ate the whole thing. It's got into me. You came up with that?" Kat grinned. "Yes, and it's all thanks to Grandma's skillet." Her mother's eyes narrowed. "Your grandma wasn't known for her cooking skills." "Huh. Well, maybe it's a family heirloom. It's definitely old. Found it hidden away in the back of a closet." "Hmm." Her mom's considering stares smooth into a smirk. "When can I be invited over for dinner?" Over the months, Kat's inspiration grew. One of her friends brought an acquaintance who worked at an art gallery and insisted on showing her work to his boss. She was going to have her very first art exhibition in a small but well-respected gallery. Damien hoarded the baking plan, always making excuses as to why he couldn't return it. He incorporated muffins, cupcakes, and popovers into his daily mix of menu offerings. Her life flowered like a movie, and she was a little tired each morning from being consumed by Carmine Rivers of fire. Well, it was the price of an overly imaginative mind. Now, her mom was a frequent visitor and often stayed late to help clean up. The relationship grew in a way she had always yearned. Everything in her world was perfect until Josie came to town. Banging on her door brought Kat out of a fugue state. She'd been trying to mix the right intensity of indigo for the garlic spear she was painting. "I'm coming," she yelled. It sounded like someone had brought a battering ram. Kat wiped paint on her pants before grasping the handle. On the other side stood Josie. They both stared at each other for a full minute before she spoke. "Jesus Christ, Kat, are you on a new diet?" "Josie, this is unexpected." Her ex traveled for work, enough that it impacted their relationship, and after 2 years of dating, they broke it off. Josie reached down and touched her collarbone. "Seriously, Kat, it looks like you're going for heroin chic." She tamped down the warmth that trickled from that touch. Kat pulled back. "I'm fine. I'm only in town for a few days. May I come in?" Kat opened the door wider and gestured for her to enter. Josie stood in the middle of the room, looking at the painting stacked against the wall. "What happened to your furniture?" "I moved it. I needed the space." "I can see that," Josie frowned, her perk nose twitching in a way that made Kat think of soft, fluffy rabbits. "I stopped by the restaurant last night. I'd read about Damien's pastries in the paper. It didn't sound like his style, so naturally I had to see for myself. The crab center with aioli glaze was enough to make me come. Jenna told me that it was you who got him started. Me, or possibly one of the pans I found I was getting at Grandma's house. I was sorry to hear she passed." "Yeah, me too. Can I offer you something to drink?" "Sure." Once they'd set out the table, both with infused iced teas of nectarine and fresh mint, Kat chose to speak her mind. "So, what brings you by?" "I heard to see Josie and know she wasn't hers anymore. After talking to Jenna last night, it seems like a lot's changed. Tried calling, but..." Kat chuckled. "Yeah, I'm constantly misplacing my phone, and I've turned off the ringer, so I'm not interrupted during a creative spell." A key sounded in the lock, and they both jumped. The door opened, and Barry strolled in, arms full of groceries. Kat went to help him. Barry glanced from Kat to Josie. "Sorry, I wasn't aware you had company. I didn't want to disturb your work." He tilted his head. "Josie." "Hey, Barry." Josie's tone cooled. "I'll leave you to it, then. Dinner at 8 tonight?" "Perfect." Kat could cut the awkward tension in the room with her palette knife. "Thanks for shopping for me today," she gave him a peck on the cheek to annoy Josie. He shot the peace sign before heading out. "What is going on here?" Josie demanded. "What do you mean? You don't get to walk out of my life and walk back in and be all judgmental." "Kat, are you blind? That man looks morbidly ill." Kat shook her head in confusion. "You should be buying him groceries, not the other way around. Is he sick? Taking too many drugs? You know he's in recovery. Are you sure about that?" "Of course I'm sure. He's my friend. I see him every day. He helps me with dinner. He's been present in my life, unlike some people." Josie studied Kat. "Okay, I guess I deserve that. But this has been hard on me, too." She reached out her hand to touch the tips of Kat's fingers. Kat wanted to relent, to take Josie in her arms, to show her what she'd been up to, how she spent the time after the breakup, but she wasn't sure her heart could take the rejection. "Are you doing anything tonight? Why don't you come over? Get here early and you can help me prep, say 6. "Gotta finish this," she paused, indicating the giant vegetable for continuing. "I have an art exhibit coming up." Josie's face lit up. "Oh, Kat, that's wonderful. I always knew you were batshit talented." Their eyes locked, but Kat glanced away first and walked over to the door. "So tonight?" Josie nodded. "I can't wait." Kat watched Josie pace about the room. Throughout the dinner, Josie became increasingly antsy. Why couldn't she enjoy herself like everyone else? When Barry left, Josie practically slammed the door behind him. She took a deep breath and scrutinized Kat. "What'd you think of dinner?" Kat asked. She'd made a seafood cassoulet with fresh mussels, clams, and Copper River salmon, which had been caught that morning. Josie walked to the table and pulled out a chair for Kat before taking a seat herself. "Kat, we've got to talk." "Okay, but you could come right out and just say you hated the meal." "Damn it, Kat, the meal was great, but can't you see what's going on right in front of you?" "What are you talking about?" "Not a single person at your table appeared healthy. Your mother was puffy with chub, which is a far cry from the share I know. Barry looks like he's close to turning sideways to walk through the door, not to mention his skin is sickly and sallow. The only person who seemed remotely robust was the fisherman Barry invited, but he hasn't been coming to your soirees, has he?" "What's that to do with anything? Why can't you just be happy for me?" Kat stood. "Look around you. Something is seriously off. Since when do you cook like a Michelin chef? Everyone gorging like mosquitoes ready to lay eggs. Your friends have put on weight, yet you can't keep any on. Don't you wonder about your sudden obsession with food?" "I think you should go." "Kat, open your eyes. Something's not right. It's that pan. Isn't that what you said earlier? You found the pan, suddenly became inspired." "Seriously, Josie, leave." Anger seethed under the surface of her skin. How dare she try to ruin all Kat worked to build. Josie stood going to the coat rack for her purse. She turned suddenly and grabbed Kat's wrist. If you don't believe me, can you promise to take Barry to a doctor? Get him checked out. Kat yanked her arm away. Since when do you care about Barry? Jesus, Kat, I don't, but obviously you do. Wake up to what's going on around you. Take a break from cooking with that stupid pan you're obsessed with. What if you're poisoning everyone around you? Have you bothered to research your magical pan at all? If it's so bad, then why is the restaurant so popular? Why are my dinner parties so successful? Josie shook her head. I don't know, Kat, but maybe you should find out. Damien died first. A sudden cardiac arrest. When he collapsed, he was pulling her pan out of the oven. The skin melted off his face like butter before anyone realized he was down. His casket was closed. Unable to stomach stepping into his restaurant, Damien's sister hosted the wake at her home. Mira was his behind-the-scenes business manager. Kat had never met her. She found Mira sitting in the kitchen, head clutched between her palms. I'm so sorry about Damien. The world fell flat. Her grief was all-encompassing, but her expression of it felt as meaningless as sentiment written on toilet paper. Mira glanced up. You're Kat, right? Surprised, Kat nodded. Mira's vitriol hiss startled her. You're the one who started this ridiculous fixation. Kat sat back, face heating with embarrassment. Mira stared at Kat. Those damn baked goods he compulsively cooked in that ugly pan of yours. He couldn't stop talking about new recipes, concocting original flavors, always bringing his inventions to the house, obsessing about being the best, and always sampling, nibbling, eating. She scowled at the table. Kat's eye rested on a family photo hanging on the wall. From the kids' ages, it looked like it had been taken about a year earlier, revealing a much slimmer Mira. A prickly chill cooled her. She pulled her sweater tight. I don't know your plans for the restaurant. Oh, we'll have to close. That was Damien's dream. She trailed off as a tear trickled down her cheek. Before you sell anything off, I was hoping to grab my pan. Mira peered up in disbelief and Kat rushed on. I'm not in a hurry or anything, but I wouldn't want to lose it. It was my grandmother's. Mira studied her for a long moment before responding, You're welcome to your devil pan. When she had seen Barry for a few days, Kat began to fret. She was picking up her mail when another neighbor told her about his ambulance ride. Kat hurried to the hospital. When she arrived in his room, she couldn't reconcile the figure on the bed with her Barry. His cinnamon skin was blotchy and pallid. The long raven hair, the pride and joy of his heritage, hung in lanky, greasy clumps. When he opened his eyes, rotten yolks were revealed. Kat became afraid. Hey, Kit Kat, his voice raspy, like it hadn't been used in months, not days. Barry, why didn't you call me? I could have been here in an instant. Kat put her hand over his, clasping him gently. Oh, I didn't want to trouble you, he gasped a dry cough. What happened? A sad smile touched his lips. Guess my hard living in the old days caught up with me. But you're not old. Apparently, pancreatic cancer isn't picky about age. Oh, Barry, no. Tears burst from her eyes. Don't you worry, I'm going to beat this. I just need a little TLC. Maybe you could bring me some consomme? That'll fix me right up. Kat desperately wanted to believe him. She chopped, simmered, and poured all of her love into the broth. But it didn't fix him up. Barry was dead within the week. After her mother's funeral, Kat gutted her paintings. Taking a knife from her butcher block, she stabbed at the swollen fruits and burgeoning vegetables. The air in the apartment became vicious with the rancid decay spilling from their seams, redolent of the sulfur from her nightmares. She snapped the wooden frames across her knees, utilizing a mallet when the bruises became too much. When she was calm enough to think, Kat moved to her computer. She couldn't shake Josie's word ricocheting through her head. Had she poisoned the people she loved? She needed to find a way to jettison the pans and stop this from happening to anyone else. At first, she thought she might be able to melt the metal, but the internet informed her that without a forge, it was impossible. She grabbed Barry's keys off the counter. He owned a vintage bottle green Ford Thunderbird. His brother lived in another state and had asked Kat to keep an eye on his things until he came back. It took two trips because of their weight. When she got to the car, she opted for a remote beach that Barry had introduced her to, a few hours away. On her drive, she stopped at a hardware store to pick up a sledgehammer and work gloves. All through the trip, her gut raged and screamed with hunger. Everything from seared scallops, cocovine, and an innovative take on Ghetto Saint-Honoré assaulted her mind. She visualized Barry's unnatural eyes and her mother's unrecognizable face in Damien's closed casket to keep herself from driving to the grocery store and heading back home. When she got to the beach, the waves blended with the sky and shore in one monotonous shade of gray. Wind blew, shoving against her, she hauled the pans of the car to the dead logs scattered at the high tide line. It took some time to break down the baking instrument to shards she felt small enough to toss into the ocean. The brittle metal proved no match for her grief. Rain fell from the clouds, making the hammer and shard slick. She often missed her target. Several times she had to sit down and rest, her arms burning with unaccustomed effort. As the sky darkened and the tide rose, her hunger finally abated. Piece by piece, she hurled the remains into the crashing sea, repeating the names of those she'd lost, promising never to forget. Afterwards, she slept dreamlessly in the car, exhaustion pulling her down as surely as the tide sucked the remnants of the skillet and muffin tin. Kat woke with the sunrise, amazed at how the sun brought out the blue-green of the sea, the khaki of the sand, and the cerulean of the sky. Her hands itched for her paints, reminding her in a flash of the work she shredded at home. She considered the pieces of the gallery, all the pieces sold. Her stomach growled. She frowned, losing the ephemeral thread of thought. Instead, the neon brilliance of the 24-hour drive-in chain down the road took its place. She started the car and drove off, the ocean in her rearview mirror. Nathan watched the dirt swirl as he kicked at the small shells littering the beach. His mom's boyfriend was okay. He did give him $5 to buy something at Larry's Gas and Guzzle. However, knowing that they were trying to get rid of him made him feel like he was being paid to leave, which tainted the fun of the spending. He often wished he had a brother or sister to boss around. Heck, he'd even take being bossed if that's what took to not be lonely. His Converse left prints in the wet sand, and he was about to turn around when something caught his eye. Squatting down, he saw an unusual black pebble sticking out of the sand. Getting on his hands and knees, he dug around the object until he discovered it wasn't a rock at all. It was a toy soldier. Further along the shore, he spied little dark objects peppering the sand. He ran along the shoreline, collecting as many as he could. He pulled his red sweatshirt into a basket, using it to collect his finds. When he could no longer outrun the waves, he wrapped the bundle tight against his chest and walked to the beach to the soft, dry sand, where grizzled seagrass grew. Sitting on a small slope, he studied his treasures. The obsidian figures were made of a heavy, dark metal that twinkled with different colors depending on how he turned them in the sun. These were unlike those cheap green soldiers his friends had. He boasted both men and women, posed not only with weapons, but like real people taking their leisure. Each soldier was intricately designed with fine details, like the creases around one man's eyes, or the delicate ash dangling from a half-smoked cigarette. None of them had the same face. If he squinted his eyes, he almost thought that he could detect subtle movement. The bright joy of imagination filled him. The metal warmed his hands, and he knew he'd discovered something special, and by extension, he would be special too. He stood, filling a sweatshirt pocket with his cash, excited to show his friends Micah. In his hand, he held a lone soldier transfixed by the swirlless eddies of color. Looking at the bottom base, he found a small stamp. Peering at the tiny type, he read, "Property of TNUH." The end. So I had a look. Okay. I had to look it up because I was like, TNUH, is this even the same thing? I didn't realize KOOC is cook backwards and now this is hunt backwards. Literally had to be told in the comments, just read it backwards.
Damn.
I would like a sequel to this because I'm like, what does it just appear different for different people? What was it for her grandma? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, for real. So it's just like a never ending type thing.
Yeah, I was also curious at first whenever her ex-girlfriend was like talking to her, I was like, oh, is it like maybe I thought that they meant like it was like lead poisoning or something from an old ass pan. I didn't think it was supernatural. I was like, oh, okay, nope, it's supernatural.
Yeah. All right, this is gonna be the last story.
Okay.
It is titled "I've Had the Same Dream for 26 Years." It was written by Alan Lowe. The things that haunt a man most are not usually the choices that he's made, but rather the choices that he never did make. I lived through some of the worst hells that you could ever imagine. 9,490 of them, to be exact. Every night when I lay down to sleep, I find myself praying for the same thing, sleep, with the absence of dreams. Every night is exactly the same. This trend started 26 years ago when I was 10. The first time that the nightmare overtook my dreams, I had come home from the worst day of my life. My dad had taken me to a splash park. It wasn't much, just a couple water jets that shot up into the air that kids could run around under and cool off from the heat. We were poor growing up and never could afford to go to any big water parks, but the splash pad was always fun. That is, until that day. I remember running around under the jets, carefree, enjoying the sweet relief that the cool water brought as it slashed on my red skin. There were a couple of the other kids there too, but I didn't pay much attention to them, as I was always a bit of a loner, even as a child. "Kyle, come on, buddy, it's time to go," I heard my dad say from the bench that sat across the way. "Oh, come on, Dad. Just a little longer," I pleaded, not noticing the little girl that was making her way towards me from the other side of the pad. "5 more minutes," he replied, shaking his head and smiling. As I turned back towards the water jet, happy for the extra time to play, I was met with the little girl standing not even a foot away from me. My heart felt as though it was going to jump out of my chest as I noticed her face. It looked decayed. Her eyes were sunken back into her skull. They were
the
pure.
Ew.
They were pure white, and her mouth was wide open. She stood there, gazing at me inches away, mouth hanging open for what seemed like hours. I couldn't move. I was frozen at the sight of this hideous girl. After a while of this, I finally regained my ability to speak and said in a shaky voice, "Hi, I'm Kyle. What's your name?" The girl turned her head to the side like a dog does when he's trying to understand what you're saying to him. "Wah?" She let out a long gasp in response. Her breath hit my face. It smelled like smoke and burnt hair. It wasn't until I stopped choking that I realized she had burns all over her arms and legs.
The fuck?
Long singe marks going up the sides from foot to waist, the skin hanging off from several places. I turned in fear back toward my dad, hoping he would see the girl and come rescue me, but he was chatting with another kid's mom on the bench, not even looking in my direction. As I turned back to face the little girl, she was gone. I ran hard and fast to where my dad was sitting. "Hey, buddy, you finally ready to go?" he said, smiling, but his facial expression quickly changed as I got close to him. "What's wrong? What happened?" he asked, concern now mixed into his tone. "The girl over by the pad," I replied through heavy breaths. "She's hurt, or burned, or I don't know." Looking over my shoulder to the pad, my dad asked, "What girl? I don't see anyone." "Kyle, let's go home. I think you've had too much sun today." I didn't argue. Maybe I had just imagined it. We walked back to the car. Dad was talking to me, but I didn't hear anything he was saying. I was too preoccupied, looking over my shoulder back toward the pad, searching for the little girl. My dad basically had to push me back to keep me from walking straight into the car door as he yelled it open for me. "Whoa, champ, watch where you're going. I can't afford a hospital visit if you bust your noggin open on the car door. We will come back to play another day, I promise." The car ride seemed much longer than usual. My mind was still thinking about the little girl. Where had she come from? Surely her parents would be looking for her to get her wounds patched up. As my dad and I pulled into the driveway, I could see my mom coming out to greet us. "He's a little shook up. Too much sun, I think. Better get him inside and cool him off." I could hear my dad tell her after their usual welcome home kiss and hug. After we ate dinner, Mom came up to my room as I was getting ready for bed. She closed the door, which was strange considering she normally came in, picked up my dirty clothes, and gave me a hug and kiss goodnight. There was something strange about her facial expression, something different about her tone of voice as she said, Your dad told me about the splash pad. What did you see? A little reluctantly, I recounted the events, not leaving out any detail. Mom just sat on my bed listening. Her new expression never changed as I concluded the story. There is something you need to know, Kyle, but this stays between you and me. I don't want your father knowing about this. She said while I looked nervously at her. My parents were always a perfect couple, even through the hard times. They always loved each other. They never fought or had harsh words between them. So I thought of her keeping anything from my dad seemed odd to me, and I didn't really like the idea of it. We come from a long line of mediums. She stopped as if trying to really think of the right way to explain. What you saw was an omen. Not particularly a bad one, since the girl didn't touch you and she disappeared. Still, you need to be aware of a few things. Her eyes started to water as she continued. These kind of omens are never good. In this case, I believe that the little girl was killed in a fire, and that she came to you because you're like a magnet to the spirits that still walk the earth. I didn't know what to say. I had no idea what she was talking about. I thought that ghosts were just make-believe, and now she's telling me that I attract them? Finally, after staring at her for a while, in disbelief, I asked, "Are you a medium?" She laughed, confused me for a second, before she replied with a big smile, "Oh heavens, no, baby, I'm not a medium. Do you really think I could have kept that secret from your father all these years?" "No, your grandmother, my mom, was a medium." "So what does this mean for me?" I asked. "It means that things are going to start happening around you. Lights flickering, shadows in your room, moving at night, waking up to voices talking to you, premonitions, and dreams." There it was, dreams. The very thing that would plague me every night for the next 26 years. I never did see any ghost or any other weird things that my mom spoke of. Just the dreams. After our talk, my mom left the room, leaving me scared and confused about all the new information she had just offloaded onto me. I laid down and turned out my lamp. I lay awake for some time, spooked, rapidly looking around my room, searching for anything out of the ordinary, when sleep finally took me. The first thing I saw was a building on fire. It was a large two-story house at the end of the cul-de-sac. The mailbox read 322 James Street. There were fire trucks with ladders and firefighters pointing hoses toward the inferno, trying to extinguish the flame. I became a little disoriented from all the lights and of the sirens. It was dark outside, and besides the fire that engulfed the house, the only lights were from the emergency vehicles, and they were blinding. I stumbled a little as I looked down toward the ground to regain my bearings. I realized that I was wearing firefighting equipment. I reached my hand up and felt the helmet on my head. I could hear someone shouting something from behind me. I turned back around to see who it was, nearly hitting another firefighter with an axe I had in my hand. I hadn't even realized I was carrying it until that moment. A man standing by a red SUV with the words "Fire Chief" on the side was looking right at me. "Kyle, go!" he shouted, pointing at the blazing house. I didn't know what I was doing, but at the same time, it felt like I've done this before, 100 times over. I turned back to the house, running full speed towards the flame. Even with my protective gear on, I could feel the extreme heat radiating off the blaze. I then heard someone's voice come over the radio. Parents say there's a little girl trapped in the second-story bathroom. Without hesitation, I responded, "10-4, I'm making an entry now. Keep on my 6 and stay sharp. Watch for falling debris. This kid is not dying on my watch." Me and two other firefighters made our way into the house. The black smoke that billowed in front of me almost blacked out the hallway where we were traveling down. I could hardly see 10 feet ahead. We pushed forward with the hose slung over our shoulders. There's the stairs, I yelled, pointing to my right as we continued down the hallway. The stairs were not yet on fire, save for a few burning embers that had fallen from the top floor. I made my way up, tapping on each step with my Halligan bar to make sure they were stable. The climb was slow and the hose was heavy. Once we got to the top of the landing, I could see flames engulfing the side of the walls and roof going down on the second story hallway. The heat was almost too much to bear. We made our way to the first door on the right, touching it to feel for heat. If there was a fire on the other side of the door and we opened it, we could cause an explosion, potentially killing us all. After determining that there was no fire on the other side, I began to scream. Holly, Holly, are you there? No answer. I don't know how I knew what name to call. It just came to me. I tried the knob and it was locked. If you're in here, stand away from the door. I'm going to break it down. I yelled before swinging my axe at the door. It took 3 swings before it opened. As I stepped into the bathroom, I heard a large crash from behind me. It shook the entire house. Looking back, I could see that part of the roof caved in, blocking the hallway to the stairs. Frantically, I searched for the girl. She was sitting in the tub, unconscious. Another crash, this time causing an explosion in the hallway, blowing out the window at the end. I could hear the glass shatter and feel the pressure from the blast. Get the girl, we have to get out of here, I could hear someone say on the radio. I reached down, picking her up and cradling her against my chest. As I turned back to leave, the other two firefighters were using the hose to put out the fire from the fallen beam so that we would have a safe path to leave from. Slowly, testing every step, we made our way back down the hallway, the flames becoming more violent, the heat growing more and more intense with each passing moment. Just as I made it to the stairs, one of the other firefighters pushed past, almost knocking me off my feet as he ran by, flying down the stairs in fear. Fuck! I cursed as I slammed into the wall, flinging the legs of the little girl into the fire. I could hear her skin sizzle in the flames.
Oh my god.
As I began to regain my balance, I saw why the other man had fled. The main beam in the roof was falling right towards me. With a loud crash, it pinned me to the ground, causing me to drop the little girl. She was still unconscious, lying directly in the flames to my right. My head spinning, I tried to push the beam off me, but it was no use. It was too heavy. After a few minutes of pushing, I gave up, feeling the flames burning my skin. The fire was beyond control. I was stuck, with no hope. My heart was pounding with the thought of the little girl burning to death, as well as my own fiery doom. I lay there in agony, feeling the flames licking the skin of my hands. I watched as the rest of the burning roof collapsed onto me. I awoke, drenched in sweat, screaming. My mother rushed into my room, fear on her face. After calming down, I recounted the dream. Her hands covered her mouth and tears streamed down her face as I spoke. She didn't say anything. She just sat there holding me. It's been 26 years to the day since that first dream, and every night has been the same since. The same house, same girl, same death. As I'm sitting here writing this, I can hear the alarm sounding, and a voice just came over the intercom. Now I have a hard choice to make. 1070, structure fire. All units respond. 322 James Street.
Okay. The thing is, if I had a dream for 26 years of me becoming a firefighter and dying in a fire and the little girl I'm trying to save dying in a fire, I would not become a firefighter.
Right?
That's the only loose end in the story. I'm like, why did he still become a firefighter?
I think it just sort of happened. Maybe he didn't plan to.
Yeah. Or he knew it was his destiny. It's kind of like a paradox.
True.
He knew he was going to become one, so he became one. And the only reason he knew he was going to become one is because he dreamt it. I don't know. That's weird. All right. On that spicy fiery note, this could be it for us this week. If you guys want to email us, you can at thespookyshit.pod@gmail.com or to our Instagram or spookyshit_pod, and our website is spookyshit-pod.com. Do you have anything else to add, Brayden?
No, I just was going to say thank you for listening.
Thank you. And if you are also going through a heat wave, drink a lot of water. Shit's rough. Stay hydrated. And if you're cold right now, consider yourself lucky.
For real, though.
All right. We'll talk to y'all next week. Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye. Mm-hmm.